rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And happy Thomas Jefferson birthday, my friends. Today, the birthday of Thomas Jefferson, we will be exploring Jefferson and his life and some of the things he left us that have consequence today as we continue on with the program. Later on in the second hour of our program, David Smith is going to be on with his new book, Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequence. However, in the first hour here, Steve Malloy is with us. He's an adjunct fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, website freeenterpriseactionfund.com, and of course, CEI.org, the Competitive Enterprise Institute.org. And should corporations be responsible to we the people? Question. Steve, you took on, and on the one hand, I want to salute you for your activism. I think people should be activists. On the other hand, you and I have a different perspective on this stuff, but you took on Goldman Sachs recently.
Uh-huh.
Tell us about that. You took on, actually, Hank Paulson, the CEO of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, well, we took on the CEO for two main reasons. One, it appeared to us that he was using shareholder assets for his personal hobbies, which include, he's an environmental activist, and so he's using shareholder monies to fulfill that hobby of his. And then the other thing is,
well, that's just specifically what that was that Goldman Sachs bought 680,000 acres of land in Chile and then donated it to the Wildlife Conservation Society.
Right.
And he is the chairman of the Nature Conservancy, which works with the society, and his daughter's on the society's board of directors.
Right. And the Nature Conservancy is an environmental activist group. And as chairman of the Nature Conservancy, he's taken its agenda and transplanted it into Goldman Sachs.
Right. So you don't object to his taking millions of dollars in salary and stock options and flying around on the corporate jet with the gold-plated faucets. That doesn't bother you. What bothers you is the fact that he gave some land to the Nature Conservancy.
Well,
I'm serious. Question. You're a stockholder.
Hank Paulson makes a lot of money for his stockholders. The compensation can be, lots of CEOs, their compensation can appear to be excessive. We think that the relative harm to shareholders in Goldman Sachs from the his salary is a lot less than what he's doing by taking the Nature Conservancy agenda and making that Goldman Sachs agenda. We think that's
How much did that 680,000 acres cost?
Well, Goldman valued it at $35 million. I think that it's worth actually a lot more because it had all sorts of natural resources that could have been exploited by the people of Chile that won't be exploited now. We've got some more information coming on this later. I don't want to get into too many details, but Goldman, it's worth at least $35 million.
So your argument here. We're talking with Steve Malloy of Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Your argument basically boils down to a corporation really has no business being in the philanthropy business, that corporations shouldn't be philanthropic. They should be all about making money and making money for their stockholders. And that's pretty much what the law says, by the way.
Is that
an accurate characterization?
No, I think it's a little too stark. I think our view is that corporations already do a tremendous amount of social good by providing goods and services they do. And they need to stick to doing that sort of fulfilling that sort of role. They're not backup governments.
Right. Well, the bottom line is, I think you just said what I said. Only you put a friendlier patina on it. I could have just as easily said corporations should be making money by providing goods and services that we all want.
Yeah.
And okay. So we're in agreement on that.
Yeah.
Now, but here's the problem. Because of things like the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, CAFTA, where corporations actually sit on the governing boards of these organizations, these multinational organizations, and they and because there are treaties involved with the United States that brought these organizations into existence, these corporations have the power to literally invalidate laws passed by you and me, by the voters of this country. And in fact, it's happened on numerous occasions. These corporations that you hold in such high esteem are taking the role of quasi-governments already. And they've already done this with regard to our trade policy.
Let's not put words in my mouth.
Okay. Well,
we hold the ideal of businesses in esteem. The reality is often not a pretty picture. And I agree with you that corporations do often circumvent laws that have been made by the citizens, and we oppose that.
No, I'm not talking about circumventing laws. I'm talking about actually changing laws.
Well,
for
changing
example,
laws,
for...
right? Well, we can say the same thing right now about global warming. Okay, you've got Goldman Sachs, GE, a number of other corporations, actively lobbying to change the law for a variety of reasons, none of which are in the interest of consumers, the economy, shareholders, or anybody else.
You mean they're actively lobbying to stop global warming, and you consider that not to be in the interest
of... Well,
they're
not. No one's... No, they're lobbying.
You're not buying my premise that global warming is real.
Well, says you.
So, yeah, right. okay.
You,
well, but Steve, the bigger picture here, Steve Malloy with Competitive Enterprise and with Free Enterprise Action Fund.com, the bigger picture here, and this is one I think that really you and I and all people who, all thoughtful people really need to be considering, is in a world where corporations are replacing governments very quickly, and certainly where we have people running the United States government who believe that corporations should replace government. We have the privatizing of the army now. The second largest army in Iraq, for example, is private corporations, both in terms of combat and certainly in terms of support functions that traditionally were done by the army, like running the PX and doing kitchen duty and whatnot, delivering the mail. Halliburton's doing that now for the army. All these kinds of things. So as the functions that have traditionally been done by we the people, by government, are being replaced by corporate activity, and as corporations are taking on the power through these multilateral trade agreements to tell us, for example, when we passed laws that said tuna has to be dolphin safe to be sold in the United States, and after NAFTA, corporations sitting on the Chapter 11 boards of NAFTA ruled that was a violation of the treaty that we signed that created NAFTA. It was a violation of fair trade, of international trade, free trade, rather, and that because Mexico's tuna was not dolphin safe and ours was, that we were blocking the import of the... And so, therefore, a law that the Humane Society of the United States lobbied for 25 years to pass was passed with the majority support of Americans, had to be repealed, even though we wanted it, even though we passed it, because a corporation said, you've got to repeal this law. With corporations taking this much power, how can we have any sort of functioning future in this world if they don't also take on some sort of social responsibility? Now, this is not the direction that I think we should go, by the way, but you're arguing against them even being socially responsible.
Look, what we're arguing for is businesses should just do what they do best, provide goods and services, and leave the rest to duly elected or democratically elected governments. That's all we're saying. We don't see corporations taking over the role of government, although the role of government should probably shrink. Everyone needs to just stick with what they do best. Governments in setting up the rules of the game and enforcing those rules, corporations creating wealth for society, and charities, taking care of the cracks in society.
So do you think, for example, Social Security, you think this should be privately done, or this should be...
No, I think people should have ownership interest in their Social Security, which they don't.
In other words, it should not be a government project. This should be privatized.
People should own their Social Security. The money that's taken out of the check, they should own.
Well, if we are all shareholders in the United States of America, if we own this country, we do own our Social Security, Steve.
No, you really don't, because you can't pass it down. All the money, you could die when you're, age...
I'm passing down a functioning society. That's part of the... that's the social contract.
Social Security, Medicare, all these entitlements, we're getting off far afield from the topic. They're just going to eat up the federal budget, and we're not going to be able to. They're Ponzi schemes.
But what if they are?
Ponzi schemes.
But this is the federal budget.
Unsustainable.
We have decided that this is part of the functions of government that we want to have. We don't want corporations. Corporations will be skimming money off the top and making out like bandits.
I don't know that we've decided. We've kind of inherited this system. It's been in the...
It was decided by we the people. You might not like it, but guys were voted into office. Franklin Roosevelt was reelected four times.
Okay, but I didn't vote for Franklin Roosevelt. What I'd like to do is have the opportunity to vote on a revamping of the system. Okay.
So in the famous words of
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
You agree with Mr. Limbaugh, I take it.
Well, I think that, you know, we're going to have to fix Social Security and Medicare and all the entitlements because they're just going to swallow up the federal budget. They're already 60%.
And you're going to continue doing everything you can to stop any corporation from doing anything that might slow down global warming, whether or not it exists.
If it doesn't exist, they don't have to do anything now, do they?
If you're willing to take that chance with your children's future, fine. I'm not.
Well, I can look at the physics and tell you whether global warming is happening, whether anything can be done about it. That's not a difficult exercise.
Tell that to the people in Biloxi. Steve Malloy, Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, FreeEnterpriseActionFund.com. Steve, thanks for being with us today.
Bye-bye.
Good conversation. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program, where we dare to ask the question, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. No, I'm certain it's not. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Hey you, would you help me to carry the stone? Open your heart, I'm coming home.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Back in 1970, Milton Friedman wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine that really defined the whole Chicago School of Economics idea of what a corporation is and what it's all about. And he suggested that basically the social responsibility of business is simply to make money, and that businesses should not be socially responsible organizations. They shouldn't be making contributions. They shouldn't be making donations. And, you know, I have to say, in the context of the point of business is to make money, I find it hard to disagree with that. However, here's the problem. We have now given corporations more than simply the right to make money. We have given them the right to influence legislation. At one time in the United States, that was a crime. We have given them the right to buy legislators, to donate to legislators. At one time in the United States, that was a crime. We have given them the right to change the laws of sovereign nations. For hundreds of years, that was impossible. We have given corporations so much of our governance. And now, ever since Reagan came into office and began the process of turning the normal functions of government, the normal things that we the people would do for ourselves without skimming money off the top so that we can hand profits off to shareholders, but holding on to those profits and reinvesting them in our infrastructure, in our roads, in our schools, in our traffic systems, in our air traffic system, in our railroads, in our food supply, since we began privatizing these things and skimming the cream off the top and giving them to corporations, what we have ended up with is corporations that have become more than they should be. Now, you could argue, and it was argued back in the 70s, and it is still to this day, that a corporation doing a social good is a desirable thing if that social good returns a profit to the corporation. And this is generally how corporate philanthropy is done. For example, a corporation will, you know, buy a park, and the park gets named after them. And so they put $100,000 into the park, and they, you know, take a tax deduction on it, but they justify it to their board of directors by saying, that $100,000, because our name's on that park, we're going to sell enough product to make that $100,000 back in profits plus more. That's traditionally how corporations have to justify this. And this goes back to a Supreme Court ruling back in, as I recall, the 1930s in the state of Michigan that involved the Ford Motor Company. And, in fact, Henry Ford was being sued over, you know, over social philanthropy, right, raising wages to his employees. How dare he do that, right? He's screwing it up for the rest of the auto manufacturers. So, anyhow, Milton Friedman and the Chicago School, their theory is corporations should just make money. And if that's all corporations did, I'd say, yeah. But the problem is that we have given corporations personhood. We have given and they should not have personhood. We have given them the rights of persons. They should not have the rights of persons. We've given them First Amendment right to lie. We've given them the Fourth Amendment right of privacy. We've given them the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent and not incriminate themselves, and all the other protections associated with the Fifth Amendment, you know, against double jeopardy and so on. We've given them Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendments rights to trials by jury and so on, the ability to litigate endlessly, it seems. And, you know, some of these arguably corporations should have the right to a trial, arguably. But I think that corporations are created by government. This is the thing that we keep forgetting. Corporations are creatures of us, of society. We, society, we collectively get together and we say we are going to establish the right of a corporation to exist. And we do this. You know, if you want to start a corporation, you have to go to the local Secretary of State's office and file articles of incorporation. We do this at the state level. The word corporation does not exist in the Constitution, and that's why there are only a small handful of federal corporations, federally chartered corporations, because to create a corporation at the federal level literally requires an act of Congress. So Amtrak and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, before they were turned private, federally chartered corporations, you know, there's a few federally chartered corporations, the FDIC, the Federal Reserve Banks. But by and large, corporations are created and chartered at the state level, and the deal, the compact, the contract that we create with people who start corporations, and I'm speaking as one of them, right, is you're welcome to run a corporation and make money in our society. You're welcome to use us as consumers and sell your product. In fact, we think that would be a great thing if you've got something good to sell us. But the day your activity begins being toxic to we the people, we reserve the right to put an end to the existence of your corporation. And in fact, corporations were routinely subject to the corporate death penalty up until the 1880s in the United States. And thousands a year in states all across the United States for not behaving in ways that were serving society. So you have to behave in a way that at the very least doesn't harm society and make money. And we have lost track of that. This whole the whole Friedman Chicago School sets aside that notion. It is anti-historical. It doesn't take into consideration the history of corporations, going all the way back to the Boston Tea Party when we first rose up as a people and said, no, we're not going to put up with Walmart-like behavior. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Just another poor boy out to fight a rich man's war. Bob and an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue, and ball will land in. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. I stack over due bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now, he's still in, chasing ghosts and thin dry air. He went back at home, the finance company took his car. Just another poor boy off to find a rich man's war.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Shelby over at radiopower.org writes, my building was struck by lightning during a storm that suddenly rolled in around 10 p.m. last night. Pretty freaky experience. I could actually hear and feel the pulsing of electricity. Wiped out computers, servers, 10 drives, archive files, mixer controls, and started a small electrical fire. I'm in the process of determining what's lost and what can be saved. I've managed to take apart a server and 3 fried desktop computers and use the parts to get Radio Power's main server back online. Station will limp along like this for the next few weeks. But without emergency fundraising of $5,000, we won't last very long. So people, if you're listening to our program on RadioPower.org or anyway, and you support RadioPower.org, go to their website, www.radiopower.org/donations, and you can help them out. So sorry to hear about that, Shelby, and you know, hope things work out well for you. Welcome back to the program. And we've been talking about, oh, by the way, for those of you who, you know, light a candle, say a prayer, send good vibes, whatever, on Saturday, I'm going to need it. 8 o'clock Eastern time, 5 o'clock Pacific time. Looks like I'm going to be on Heartland with John Kasich on Fox TV. So debating some conservative on some issue, and we'll see what comes of that. But anyway. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Brett in Spartansburg, South Carolina. Hey, Brett, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm just great, but I'll get better, Brett. What's up?
All right. Let me tell you, you got the best radio program on.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
I wish Sirius would have you on 3 hours straight.
Well, we're very grateful to Dave Gorab and the folks at Sirius for the hour that we are on live, and then the other 2 hours broadcast a little bit later on in the day, but we're pleased to be on here. So what's up, Brett?
I just want to say that, you know, all those people that work at Walmart and get help from the government, that's not social welfare like this fellow's talking about. That's corporate welfare.
We're right, it's allowing
Walmart rent.
It's allowing Walmart to do business because you and I are picking up the tab for the health care for their employees. Is that your point?
That's the point.
Yeah.
And every company like them, too, as well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with you, Brett. I absolutely agree with you. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
Jay in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I haven't been listening to you guys for a little while. I needed to take a break from all the baloney going on. But the Libby leak or revelation, I know I don't have to explain to you and your listeners what that entails. And I'm just wondering if anyone out there from the right has said anything that makes any sense whatsoever to mitigate that.
No.
So how is he still in office? The cat's out of the bag. How come this isn't being dealt with properly?
Because the Republicans are in control of the House and Senate, and they refuse to allow any sort of investigation. And what most Americans, I think, don't realize is that the party in power in the House or the Senate is the only party that has the power to enforce a subpoena, that is to compel testimony from a witness. And so the Democrats are not allowed to hold hearings, and the Republicans aren't going to.
I grant it from an official point of view, the formal point of view, that's the case. But what about just the press and the average Joe, but the press in particular, when they're standing in front of him or McClellan and saying, look, the emperor has no clothes, the cat's out of the bag, you have no credibility, and you can pretend all you want otherwise, but the jig is up. And, I mean,
yeah,
it takes the press to force that issue and to treat him with hostile contempt.
Well, this is a press that is owned by large multinational corporations who, at least one of them, certainly NBC, all of their, you know, conglomerates are a major in the defense industry and nuclear weapons manufacturing, or nuclear power manufacturing, rather. And we also have a situation where the members of the White House press corps have achieved a status in television that didn't exist in the day of Walter Cronkite. I mean, literally back in the day of Walter Cronkite, Dan Rather, those guys, they were making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, or maybe the equivalent in today's money of $100,000 a year at the most. I mean, it was not a highly paid job. It was a high status job, but it wasn't a high paid job. And now these guys, you know, some of them are making millions of dollars a year being on TV, and they know that the day that they ask a hard question at the White House is the last day that the White House will take their question, which means that's the last time that their network is going to find them to be of any value, and therefore they don't ask the hard questions. So it's a combination of the corporate pressure from the top down, like MSNBC dumping Phil Donahue, even though he was the only profitable show on the entire network and the most profitable show, more profitable than any show they ever had, including Hardball, dumping him because of his anti-war positions, and the star syndrome that's going on that keeps these guys from asking serious questions, this confluence, and it's really, frankly, all the result of Ronald Reagan stopped in the 1980s enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, which allowed corporations to get bigger and bigger and bigger and more powerful, number one. And number two, Bill Clinton signing the Telecommunications Act in 1996, combined with Reagan's deregulation the limited deregulation of the broadcast and media industries, so that we now have these we're now in the infotainment business. I remember the day when CBS spun off, you know, said, okay, our news division is now part of our entertainment division. That was something that back when I started out in radio in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, as a reporter, I started as a reporter actually in 72, it would have been unthinkable. Unthinkable. So, anyway. We'll see where this goes. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. A few quick points. First of all, I wanted to agree with the caller you had before where he says, you know, you have an amazing show. I just want to tell you, it's like listening to a scholar. So, putting
well,
that aside, you're welcome.
You keep in mind, that's we have to hope nobody in management is listening because that's death in radio. You're supposed to say, it's incredibly entertaining.
The gentleman that you had on the show from the Enterprise Institute, you know, in regards to privatization of Social Security, it's interesting because many countries like Chile and England have attempted those systems and they failed at it. And it's the high amounts of cost due to the, you know, the overhead in the system. And also, you know, we have to remember, we privatize things. Corporations look at minimizing costs, maximizing profits.
Sure.
And
that's their job.
Yeah, so they have no interest. They, you know, corporations are becoming stateless. I'm sorry, Tom.
Oh, that's
I'm
okay.
Going to have to let it go there because my daughter.
Okay, I understand, Patricia. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. No, you're absolutely right, Patricia, and you make a very, very good point. I appreciate it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you again. You know, thank God for the Helen Thomases of the world. You know, the desperation of the media, those media conglomerates that you were mentioning, and the Bush administration is just unbelievable. I mean, the phony trials of Moussaoui and Hussein, I mean, proves how, on various levels, how phony this war on terror really is.
Well, both of these guys are bad guys.
Well, they are.
I mean, you're not disputing that.
The fact that the media conglomerates are using this to manipulate, especially the people that have supported Bush up to this point, and they haven't been able to use their intellect to connect the dots and to see what a fascist group of killers these are.
Mm-hmm.
And they say in public, oh, this is a war on terror, but then in private, this is a war on Satan because of the way that they've sold this invasion, this illegal invasion of Iraq.
Well, Bush clearly thinks that he's opposing evil. I mean, he's decided what's evil, and he's going to kill people to solve that problem. And he does so in a fashion that, for my taste, is frankly just far too cavalier. You go back and you look at when he was governor of Texas, he bragged about the fact that he never spent more than 20 minutes reviewing a death penalty case. He executed more people, he signed more death warrants than any other governor in the history of the United States. And we have a long history, and a lot of people have been put to death. That's an incredible record to have. And never spent more than 20 minutes on any of them. And Alberto Gonzalez prepared the records for him to evaluate, so he never looked at anything. There was more than a page or two. And Gonzalez prepared the summaries, and Gonzalez never raised any questions on any of these people. And we know from you know, the experience of every other state of the union that particularly when you're cranking them out like that, I mean, you know, 130-some-odd people over a period of a few years, that there's going to be at least a few where you want to go back and say, hey, are you really sure about this? And they're coming to light now. And, you know, ordering a war, I mean, this general who just said this the other day, that this is being done with a cavalier attitude, with the ease and comfort or whatever the phrase was, that you only see among people who have never had to serve and have never had to bury the results of these kinds of policy decisions. And that's what we're seeing. And then you get things like Bush coming out saying,
we found the weapons of mass destruction. You know, we found biological laboratories. But for those who say we haven't found the banned manufacturing devices or banned weapons, they're wrong. We found them.
Yeah, right. And thanks to Stop Vote Pirates over at Hartman Watch blogspot.com who tracked down the audio for us. George W. Bush saying, yeah, we found it. 2 days after the White House gets a report saying, nah, sorry, it's for weather balloons. But what's even more bizarre is that 4 months later, Dick Cheney is still saying the same thing. I mean, these guys, it's like, you know, honesty, truth, nah, doesn't matter. Just roll it out. Just as long as Halliburton is making money, we'll have a war. We can privatize Social Security. George W. Bush saying that he was going to have a war back in 1999. He was going to have a war with Iraq so he could get his agenda through. His agenda? Roll back the New Deal.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah, destroy America. 45 minutes past the hour.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks.
And welcome back, my friends. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Tom Hartman here with you. A couple of people have called in and said, what's that TV show you're going to be on? On Saturday, it's 5 o'clock Pacific, 8 o'clock Eastern time, The Heartland with John Kasich. I think I'm pronouncing it right. I'm not familiar with the program, frankly, but I will be after Saturday. John was a member of Congress for 18 years, and he substitutes his host for Bill O'Reilly, apparently. So, according to his bio over at Fox News. So, it's on your whatever your Fox News channel is, if you're curious.
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
Yes, Tom DeLay, United Press International, is now reporting that among the candidates to replace Josh Bolten as the director of the Office of Management and Budget, the group that, you know, inside the government that puts together the annual budget on behalf of the administration, among that bunch, the short list of candidates, former Majority Leader Tom DeLay. Yes, indeed. It's just, I'm sorry, it just cracks me up. I guess as the administration's, somebody in the administration made the comment, no one knows more about the budget. And, yeah. So our DeLay political death, Tom DeLay, the gift that keeps on giving. There's just no other way of saying it. Leanne in Lubbock, Texas. Hey, Leanne, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Oh, yes, I'm on, right?
You are.
I was just wanting to comment that I really appreciate your show, and I listen as often as I can. But
thank you.
On the topic of corporate profit and that being an appropriate motivation and the only thing business should do,
mm-hmm.
I have a thought about that, and that is that I think that going for profit only is in and of itself corrupting.
Sure.
That having profit as a means to some other goal is maybe something we should be looking for instead.
Well, this is, I mean, historically, this has been the way that we've looked at it in the United States. We've said you can make a profit as long as you're doing something that is useful, you know, not destructive, not toxic, you're not poisoning people, you're not killing people, and you're doing it in a way that is socially responsible. It doesn't mean that we're expecting you to fulfill the functions of government, but that you're doing it. And now the problem is that the imperative to increase profits is to internalize profits and externalize costs. And so for many companies, what this means is dumping, for example, their toxic waste, which it would be costly to appropriately dispose of, into the commons for the rest of us to pay for. For
yeah.
example, you know, right now, all these Superfund sites, under the Bush administration, no longer are the polluters paying into the Superfund. So they're not paying to clean up their own pollution. You and I are. It's all being thrown on the American taxpayer. And that's just wrong. There's just an enormous amount of corporate welfare out there, and Bush really turned this into a fine art in Texas. And this is why Texas is now one of the most heavily polluted states in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
By making all of the, not all, but the vast majority of the pollution controls voluntary rather than mandatory to the extent that he could. And yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's why government regulation, in the absence of government regulation, what we will end up with is a corporatocracy that will be so toxic that ultimately itself will fail, because it will either become oppressive and fascistic, you know, an unholy alliance with government,
mm-hmm.
or the people will rise up and say, enough already. I mean, we have a situation in the news today. Here's this article out of China, 200 from Reuters. 200 Chinese villagers, angry over pollution of their water supply, attacked three factories and a sewage treatment plant, a Hong Kong newspaper said on Wednesday. Villagers in the eastern province of Fujian, armed with iron bars, smashed windows and appliances on Saturday at the sewage plant, two leather factories, and a South Korean-invested plastics factory. They rushed into the office building, kitchen, dormitory, and grocery store, smashed all the glass, air conditioners, and other breakable things, and took anything valuable, including kitchen items. The paper quoted the owner of the Zindi Leather Company in Jiangsu as saying, three cars were also destroyed, he said. Police and local officials broke up the protest. What are they protesting? Protests against polluting industries are common now across China's countryside. I'm still reading from Reuters, where the environment has all too often been sacrificed in the pursuit of profits. Outright attacks are less widely reported. Villagers had complained that discharge from the sewage treatment plant, about half a mile from their homes, had polluted the water supply, damaged crops, and created a lingering stench, the newspaper said. So that's the consequence. Leanne, your point is spot on, and I appreciate your calling and making it. Thank you very much. It's well said. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Real quick here. Today's Jefferson's birthday, right?
That's right. In fact, I'm going to be sharing with you some stories about Jefferson later on in the program from my book, What Would Jefferson Do?
Okay. Yeah, I got that book. Great book. Well, first, thank you for doing FDR yesterday. I love his speeches. And also on this Jefferson, obviously the cons keep trying to co-opt Jefferson to convince us all that he was a conservative Republican. You know,
yeah, we've
that,
got
right?
George Allen now running around
exactly.
saying that he's a Jeffersonian Republican.
Exactly.
And that's like saying I'm a dog that meows.
And here I'm looking at a site called the Jefferson, it's the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College. Mr. Jefferson goes to the Middle East, and it's a whole conference for cons. And they got books here, Spirit of Democratic Capitalism, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I mean, they keep trying to do it, man.
Yeah, well, the reality is that Thomas Jefferson said he was an advocate of a limited federal government. And so, you know, the cons grab that and say, well, this is what it's all about.
Capitalism are not the same.
That's right, exactly. Well said. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. It's just, yes, democracy and capitalism are not the same thing. And Jefferson would have been the first to point it out. In fact, he wanted there to be an 11th Amendment to the Constitution. Actually, he wanted to combine the 6th and 7th, so there'd still be 10, because that was a magic number, that banned monopolies in commerce. He wrote letters to Madison all over the place about this. Didn't work, though. 57.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, my friends. Coming up on today's program, Bill Falzon, U.S. congressional candidate in California's 2nd District. Just on the edge there of Sacramento, where we're on the air, and KSAC is going to be here on our Taking My Country Back segment. And an update on Veteran Affairs with Larry Scott from VA Watchdog in our 3rd hour. For our 1st hour, are conservatives hell-bent on destroying our schools, or conservatives would say are liberals? Dr. Dominic Maglio, a neo-traditionalist culture war expert on educational terrorism and how to stop it. Dominic, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
Educational terrorism?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Tell me what this is.
What that means to me is that when people are given a position and have a job description, instead of doing what they're supposed to do, for instance, teach a subject matter, they're using their classroom with a captive audience, they're using it as a bully puppet to basically tell people, especially young, impressionable people, what they think about the world. And very often it's skewed, it's unbalanced, it's not fair, it's un-American, and it makes these kids think that really makes them feel that it's that they have no hope in the world, and America has no future. So it's a terroristic act in my mind.
So we should accuse them of terrorism and throw them in Guantanamo Bay?
I think that might be going overboard. But
well, that's what you do to terrorists.
We should fire them because they are not doing their job. And I think we have to have standards in life, and we certainly should have standards in education. It's a government school paid by taxpayers. They're paid to do a job. They should do it. If they're not doing it, if they're just spouting off and they're not doing their job, they should be removed from their particular position.
Dominic Maglio, back in the late 19th century, a guy named Horace Mann, who had gone over to Germany and seen the Prussian school system at work, a school system that was invented in 1813 in response in large part to Napoleon's having kicked the butt of the Prussian emperor at the time, who then went to Fichte, the leading philosopher in Germany, and said, how do we create an army that can defeat Napoleon? And he said, well, you've got to start with your children. You have to create an entire generation of children who don't question authority. So we will change, we will create a, and who feel more committed to the state than they do even to their parents.
Right.
And so we will create a school system that is, number one, compulsory. So they will know that the state is more powerful than their parents.
Right.
Number two, that they will be required to ask the question, may I ask a question, before they even ask a question. So they will never question authority. Number three, we don't want them to think in a holistic fashion. We don't want them to put A plus B. We don't want them to have big picture thinking. We want them to be thinking, shoot when you see the whites of their eyes.
Right.
So we break the topics into individual segments and teach them separately. And number four, we want them to be sure to be a person who takes orders. So we give drastic punishment if they don't take orders. And Horace Mann came over back to the United States, and by the way, it did create a powerful and marvelous German army. And so Horace Mann came back to the States in the 1880s and 1890s and started pitching this to industry up and down the East Coast, saying, here's the solution to the problem of people not having a good workforce, because so many people on the East Coast were migrating westward that a lot of our factories are having a hard time getting people. And he couldn't get anybody to buy it until in the 1890s, the legislature of Massachusetts, which had been taken over by a secret society, a Protestant secret society called the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, and they're called the Know-Nothing Congress of Massachusetts that year, because they had this secret handshake and they said, I know nothing. That was their secret, except it wasn't a secret. They were proud of it. They were concerned about the Catholics. All these Catholics were coming in from Ireland, from the potato famine and whatnot, and there were now more Catholics in Massachusetts than there were Protestants, particularly in Boston, and the question was, how do we break the back of the Catholics? And so they decided to use Horace Mann's technique and go into the school and just have kids learn exactly what they were taught, without any dialogue, without any discussion. To hell with the Socratic method. Forget about children questioning.
Oh, I believe in the Socratic method. I believe in getting children to think. I do not think.
This is my point. It sounds to me like you're saying the same thing Horace Mann was saying, which is we're going to have an absolutely uniform educational system teaching what the state wants taught.
You cannot get children to think if they don't know facts. We have to teach children history. We need to teach them. They have to learn. They just can't have someone, what I consider, indoctrinating them. Because
so give me an example of this indoctrination, Dominic Magler.
Indoctrination is what Jay Banish did in Colorado. It's what
Warren Churchill
does in the University of Colorado.
Give me one example, please. Let's just talk about a real case incident here.
Jay Banish.
Tell me what he did.
Well, I mean, it's pretty well known what he did. He spent 40 minutes lambasting the policies in a geography class of the United States.
Of the Bush administration.
Whatever. It doesn't matter.
Okay, so he was lambasting the Bush administration's policies.
Okay,
and you think kids should be taught history in schools. Isn't this history in the making?
What? I'm sorry?
Yeah, isn't this history in the making?
No, because he's talking about geography. Not talking. Ward Churchill gets up and he calls 9/11 victims little Eichmanns. These are
that was in college.
This is using a captive audience. No. Let me tell you, I taught college for a decade. I have a college preparatory school for the last 23 years. You have a right to discuss things as an open forum where students have a right to have their opinions, and then you have a Socratic method. You ask questions, you open a discussion, you talk about things after they have the facts. But you don't just tell them what to think. Tom, I know you would be against that. You wouldn't want anybody to get up there and start telling everyone they have to believe in Christianity, they have to believe in Islamic religion. That's not what we do in America. We have a right to discuss. And if you ever watch Ward Churchill on TV, he doesn't allow his students to rebut what he says, and that's despicable. That's tyranny.
It's also college, and the kids can say, I'm not going to take this class, I'm going to take a different class.
We're talking with Dominic Magler.
What you're really upset about is any teacher who dares...
In high school, he was not in college. Banish did the same thing. No one can speak up because a guy goes off on a tirade. And I'm saying to you, you don't think that's education. That's not guiding anybody. That's telling them what to do. That's that's exactly what you discussed about Horace Mann. I'm saying,
why, Dominic Maglio, are you so terrified of our children being exposed to ideas or opinions that may contradict yours or those of the Bush administration?
No, I think it's great to have opinions contradict, but you have to have a forum to do that. You don't do that as part of a job description to educate children in a particular subject and go off on another
then you think that education should be entirely mechanistic and entirely mechanical, and if somebody is supposed to teach geography, they're just supposed to say, here's where New Mexico is and here's where Arizona is. They're not supposed to offer their own opinions. They shouldn't be saying, this is what I think about something.
Well, you know what? That's real nice. So if someone wants to talk about what they think, go on a soapbox in the middle of 49th Street and start speaking. If people want to do that, that's fine. When you're getting paid with government tax money, that means citizens' money. They need to do a job. I have tremendous opinions. So do you. You do it in the right forum. You don't in a school that I don't go up and tell my students what to think about politics. That's not part of my job, is to educate children. It's to help them learn basic skills.
But what you are arguing is that children should be taught about politics, that they should be taught the official line about politics.
What do you mean?
Just what I said. You're saying that these guys should not be criticizing the Bush administration.
No, I didn't say
to not criticize the Bush administration is to implicitly endorse
ranting.
The Bush administration.
They're ranting. If they make a specific statement, look, there's a lot of things I detest about what's happening in the Bush administration right now. I detest to the utmost of my heart. I think that Bush is an economic internationalist. I do not agree with that, but I think he's been very deceptive about what he's done. I can talk about that, but I'm going to talk about it. Other people have different ways of looking at it, and you have a discussion. You do not take and just dominate and use a classroom as a bully pulpit, because that's terrorism.
So
that's
Dominic
terrorizing
Maglio,
our kids.
Yeah, I got your point. So are you suggesting then that we should just federalize education so that right now we have a situation where local school boards, Dominic, let me make my point here. We have a situation where local school boards hire and fire teachers. What's wrong with the local school board saying, hey, we don't like the way this guy's teaching, and fire him?
The question is, should an incompetent person be fired? I say yes. Why?
Well, I don't understand why you're trying to make a national issue out of this, unless this is just another, you know, be afraid thing, because school boards have the ability to fire teachers.
No, I don't agree, first of all, in government schools anyway. I have a private school. I believe that what we have to do,
only people who have money should be able to send their kids to school.
Oh, give me a break. That's not, you're changing the sound. I was talking about people.
Well, you just changed the subject of this.
Huh? I'm sorry.
I mean, you just changed the subject to, you know, let's do away with government schools.
No, I didn't say that. I said I am not in favor of government schools. I believe I was just speaking on another radio show, and the person said, well, you know, I was talking about bullying. The person said, well, the administrator couldn't do anything because his hands were tied. And I think that's exactly the problem in government schools. Their hands are tied. We need to have the ability to have free exchange of ideas. That happens better in private education.
Well, Dr. Dominic Maglio, drmaglio.com is website. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Good talking with you. Dominic Maglio. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So why are conservatives hell-bent on destroying our schools?
Express yourself!
Yeah, well, that's why. Because they don't like it when people express themselves. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. There's a couple of issues wrapped into this thing. As first of all, you've got conservatives out there who don't think that we should have public education. Now, why are conservatives opposed to public education? You know, sometimes the arguments that they put forward are the ones that I was making about Horace Mann. In fact, the genesis of public education in the United States is not particularly egalitarian, at least modern public education. Horace Mann was trying to create a system where everybody, you know, where everybody would become a good little robot for the factories. But the reality is that if you go back 100 years before Horace Mann to the founders of this country, Thomas Jefferson creating the University of Virginia as a free college for anybody who could go, and communities all across the United States, hiring the local school marm and bringing a teacher into town to run the one-room schoolhouse and collectively getting together and everybody digging into their pocket to pay for it, you find that the reason for education, for public education in the United States, is very simple. It's social mobility. And this highlights one of the fundamental differences between conservatives and liberals in the history of this country. The liberals like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine, James Madison, even to some extent Alexander Hamilton, the liberals who created this country, strongly believed in social mobility. They believed that regardless of the economic or social class into which a person is born, they should have the right and the ability to move into higher economic and social classes. And, in fact, that was the case in the United States for many, many years. We were one of the most socially mobile countries in the world. We are now below the United Kingdom, where they actually still have an aristocracy in terms of social mobility. The probability of your being born in poverty in the United States and moving out of poverty is lower than in any other Western country. We are the worst in the world for this. And the key to, you know, one of the primary keys anyway, to moving out of poverty is getting a good education. Now, this works very well for conservatives who believe in a social hierarchy. And that is one of the tenets of conservative thought. And no, this isn't demagoguery. Go back and read Russell Kirk's 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, in which he goes all the way back to the 1700s, the late 1700s, and the arguments that were being, you know, the conservatives at that time. And, you know, all the debates that we'll be having about what does it mean to be a conservative. And Kirk, you know, comes right out and says, you know, conservatives believe in a social hierarchy. They think it's the natural order of things. And Barry Goldwater was all impressed by that. And the conservatives of the day, William F. Buckley, I mean, constantly talking about Russell Kirk's book. I mean, this was the Bible for the conservative movement, The Conservative Mind, 1953. And if you're going to have a social hierarchy, you can't have social mobility, and you're going to have a ruling elite. And this is one of the reasons, by the way, why Limbaugh and other cons, who are the shock troops of the conservative movement, have been using the phrase elite constantly when they refer to liberals, because they're trying to immunize themselves from the reality that conservatives have been calling for 200 years for there to be an elite ruling America. John Adams believed there should be an elite ruling America. He referred to the average person, the common man, the working person, as the rabble, and felt they should have no play in democracy. They should not have a voice in government. So number one, you have the conservatives who are trying to destroy public education, because public education provides for social mobility. And if you have privatize education, you have a situation just like you have with healthcare right now. If you're a millionaire, no problem. You have access to it, the best you can get. If you're a working stiff, particularly on the low end of the working salary range, you're out of luck. You become one of the 46 million uninsured. You become one of the what would be millions of uneducated if we didn't have a public education system. So number one. Number two, there is this incredible effort underway on the part of conservatives across the United States of political correctness, of trying to scare the hell out of teachers in public schools and say, no, you're not allowed to have an opinion. This is the exact same thing the Nazis did in Nazi Germany. Any teacher who spoke out against Hitler was toast. I mean, in the early years, they were merely fired. Later on, you know, they would face much more draconian measures. They would be called, for example, traitors. Gee, where have I heard that recently? I mean, this is something I think as Americans we should be very concerned about, that right-wing talk radio all across America right now is out there pounding on the idea that our teachers are running down America. They're saying anti-American when they're actually saying things that are opposed to the Bush administration policies, number one, and which I think is very pro-American and very patriotic. And number two, we do have local school boards. We do, to a fairly large extent across the United States, still have local control of our schools. And I can tell you, you know, from personal experience, having been the parent of three kids and also being on the board of directors of a school for the last 10 years, that if parents don't like the way school is going, things change. So why do we have demagogues at a national level running around and saying, oh, this is a vital issue. We've got to stop these teachers from speaking out. And they always have two or three anecdotes, right? And you can, I mean, with anything, you can find two or three over-the-top nutcases. But that's, you know, that does not a national movement make. But shutting up teachers, that's what they're trying to do at a national level. I think it's dangerous. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Lips are pressed as right. Breaks are pressed as left. So what's left? What's right?
Past the hour. A place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. That's me. Our quote for the day from John F. Kennedy. Let us think of education as the means of developing our greatest abilities, because in each of us there is a private hope and dream, which, fulfilled, can be translated into benefit for everyone and greater strength for our nation. John F. Kennedy. By the way, No Child Left Behind, another part of the assault on public schools, so much so that United States Senator Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party over that thing. Left the Republican Party. Said enough already because of No Child Left Behind. I mean, it was the straw that broke the camel's back, obviously, but, and I salute him for that. The only Republican that I've voted for in my lifetime, frankly, Jim Jeffords. And now Bernie Sanders running for his seat. I only mourn that I no longer live in Vermont so I can vote for him. But the 10 years I lived there, I loved it. In any case, the No Child Left Behind law, which sets these, you know, basically the bottom line of the No Child Left Behind law is that instead of teachers putting together tests, you know, writing them up on the Mimeo machine and running them off for free or on a copy machine in the classroom, and saying, okay, kids, fill out this test, you know, and or do the test in the book and fill it out and hand it up to me. Instead of that, the way that it was done when I was a kid, schools now have to go to private corporations. This is part of the privatization of education. They have to go to private corporations, one of which coincidentally happens to be owned by Neil Bush, the president's brother, and buy from those corporations specific educational materials and specific testing materials so that there is a standardization of education in the United States. Our guest's mention of children being taught history brings to mind Hitler's famous comment that the, you know, history is written by the victors. In any case, so we have across the United States children being tested based, you know, via this No Child Left Behind. The cost of hundreds of millions of dollars. In fact, the educational testing business has gone from a relatively small business when Bush came into office to $1 billion a year industry now, a multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry now. Because of No Child Left Behind, school districts are required to buy these tests, and sometimes at very, very absurd prices. And if their kids don't score well, they get punished. Now, the federal government also wants the kids to score well so that Bush can run around and say, see, there's No Child Left Behind. It's working out wonderfully. Well, strangely enough, they've rigged the system. This from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Thousands of children in Indiana, and by Krista Stockman, thousands of children in Indiana and millions across the country are not being counted in the federal government's effort to leave No Child Behind academically, the Associated Press has found. The No Child Left Behind Act, enacted in 2002, is supposed to make sure all students, particularly those most at risk, including minorities, are meeting minimal standards by 2014. But it is precisely the groups the law was meant to target that are most likely to be unaccounted for in the accountability requirements. The law allows states to set their own parameters for how students will be counted after taking state standardized tests. Students must be counted as an entire group in a school or school district, as well as in subgroups such as black students, Hispanic students, or Asian students. But how large the group has to be before it is counted varies from state to state. In Indiana, for example, test scores of 21,650 children including a third of the state's Hispanic students, were not reported at the state level. Say what? Nationwide, the AP analysis of 2003-2004 enrollment figures found 1.9 million students, about one in every 14, were not counted under under the law's racial categories. Minorities were seven times as likely to have their scores not counted as were whites. In Indiana, for example, Hispanics comprised the largest subgroup of 21,650 students excluded under the clause. The test scores of about 34% of the 8,793 Hispanic students enrolled in Indiana schools were excluded from the test scores at the school level. Blacks represented the second largest group. About 8% of black enrollment was not reported. Nationally, the AP found that Hispanics and blacks have roughly 10% of their scores excluded. More than a third of Asian scores and nearly half of Native American scores are not broken out either. Less than 2% of white scores are not broken out. So the mechanism by which they count the success of No Child Left Behind is rigged. I mean, it's done just like the Ohio elections. And then there was a fascinating study done by a group in Oregon. They looked at Oregon, and because Oregon has a lot of rural school districts, and because we've got a really funky way of funding schools in the state of Oregon, one school district might spend $12,000 per student per year, and another school district might spend $8,000 per school district per year. And some are rich and some are poor, and some have high educational backgrounds among their parents, and some have low, and some represent racial minorities and some don't. And so they said, oh, this is a great place where we can do a test. And so they compared financial resources of the parents, financial resources of the community, poverty, community education levels. They compared these criteria along with how much money per student gets spent in 132 small and rural districts in the state of Oregon. And guess what they found? Quoting from the report in the Oregonian written by Steve Carter, money has the highest correlation of four factors that showed an influence on student achievement. In other words, the amount of money that you spend per child is going to be the biggest factor that's going to determine how that child's going to do. Not how rich their parents are, not how well-educated their parents are, not whether their parents are white or black, not whether they came from a good part of town or a poor part of town, not whether the community is wealthy or poor, not whether there's a lot of immigrants or not, not what their first language was. No, the amount of money per student that you spend is going to be the biggest variable that's going to determine the quality of the education as measured by the competence of that child when they graduate from school. Pure and simple. Second most important influence on achievement, Johnson said, was teacher quality, as measured by whether the teachers had emergency or provisional teaching credentials versus actual credentials in an actual field. All over America, right-wing talking points are being exploded by this study. I suspect you will not hear about it on right-wing talk radio. The average difference between high-achieving and low-achieving rural school districts in Oregon, $1,625 per student. In other words, those districts that paid the extra $1,600 per student per year had the highest student scores in the state, and those who didn't pay the extra $1,625 per student per year had the lowest-achieving students per state, and it had nothing to do with any of the other variables. Well, it had something to do. You know, they had some influence, but it really boiled down to, in education, you get what you pay for. What a surprise. You know, you've got cons running around. You know, they would be the first to say, well, I'm driving this fancy car because you get what you pay for. Well, I bought a fancy new house because you get what you pay for. Well, I want to have the very best clothes because you get what you pay for. This is a conservative mantra. What about education? Oh, no. Got nothing to do with class size. That just makes it more expensive, but that's not going to change education. Nonsense. Conservatives are simply hell-bent to destroy public education in the United States, pure and simple, number one, because it does allow for social mobility, which threatens conservative elites. And number two, they don't want our children to have critical thinking skills. They don't want our children to grow up to be adults who might question authority, because questioning authority is not something conservatives do. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Joshua in Fulton, Mississippi. Hey, Joshua, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Joshua. What's up?
Not much. When I was in high school, I'm 25 now. I'm a college graduate, own my own business. And, excuse me?
Yeah, no, I'm listening.
Okay. Anyway, my senior year in high school, we had to take government economics, stuff like that. And And our teacher proposed, he showed us all different forms of government, from dictatorships to republic to democracy, all the way down, you know, communism, everything. He said, which one of these is the best form of government? And I said, well, even though I raised my hand, I said, even though it's not the best in theory, communism would work. Because everyone's on an equal playing field, and there's no haves or have-nots.
Mm-hmm.
And with a democracy, is looking after the entire group, not just a certain part of the demographic.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Republican. I knew he was a Republican. After class, he took me to the principal and the counselor and told him that I was trying to disrupt class.
So this happens on both sides, huh?
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. You know, I said, no, I was taking my opinion.
Right.
When, you know, we're in the South. It's very, very conservative.
Right.
And
how dare you advocate for communism or socialism? Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I'm just saying, you know, I said a republic, what really made him mad, I said a republic's nothing but a light form of a dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And that blew him over. He hated that.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to argue the politics of it with you, Joshua. I think it's a fascinating story, though. Thanks a lot for sharing it with us.
I appreciate it.
That's interesting. 1-866-440-8466. Patricia in Sacramento, listening on KSAC. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Tom, did you notice on your last guest, when you asked him, he made a comment about, well, I prefer private school, and you said, well, does that mean only people with money get educated? He didn't seem like he wanted to respond.
No, he didn't.
I just thought that was so interesting, because
yeah.
That's how a lot of conservatives react to that question. But, you know, I agree with you 100%, and it's so important to have a society where everyone it has the ability to be educated. I mean, it pulls people out of poverty. It's crime goes down. I mean, there's so many, you know, benefits that go to this. But I wanted to add to this by saying I went to CSU Monterey Bay, which was a really progressive university, and I had, you know, a mixture of, we had some conservative professors, like in economics, and you know what, I've never had a problem with having debate in the class.
Yeah.
They allowed any type of debate. They gave you your opinion because we wanted to know what their opinion is.
And that's what you want. I mean, that's the American ideal, is that we listen to all opinions and we have a discussion of it. Patricia, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Great talking with you. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, please, Harry.
Things are looking bad. I know you wouldn't mind to see your favorite man. They'll find the land you love.
Indeed, we so need Harry Truman again. Good old Harry. I never gave anybody hell. I just told them the truth, and they thought it was hell. Harry Truman, the first president of the United States to introduce a national health care program, a single-payer national health care program. Rejected by the Republicans in the House and the Senate in 1946. Amazing. Welcome back to our program, Public Education, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Brad in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Brad, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
Oh, no. I was looking on the web last night, and I saw three different articles about this, all repeating the same thing, and then I heard you say it, and I had to call in. The way that the reporting guidelines work for minority groups in school, everybody's scores get reported. Okay, but if there's literally, say, for example, one African-American family in a school of 200 or 300 kids, that African-American family doesn't get broken out into a separate racial subcategory. Those three or four or five kids' scores still get reported. They still count. Okay, so if they're doing poorly, they're going to pull down the school's average. The trick is, the last school I was at, for example, almost entirely Latino and white. We literally had one black family, three kids. All three of those kids were adopted. All three of those kids had major learning difficulties. If their scores had been broken out into a separate racial category for African-American students, our school would have been labeled failing because of three kids out of 180. No Child Left Behind, there's a lot of stuff wrong. It's a bad law on a number of levels, but that particular thing is not one of them.
Oh, that's interesting. So the reason why these kids are not counted is to try to prevent the problem of statistical anomalies.
Precisely. And again, you know, this is the problem, is I keep hearing people say they're not counted. That's not true. They are counted. They count against the average of the school as a whole. They count as much as any other individual kid or any other four or five kids in the building.
Well, my position on all this, Brad, is that we shouldn't be doing this at a federal level anyway.
Absolutely not.
That we should have local control of schools. That I can't believe in my wildest imaginings that some bureaucrat in Washington D.C. or even some elected politician who has everybody's best interest at heart is going to care as much about how my kid does in my local public school as I do. Brad, your phone line has gone flaky here, but good point. Thanks a lot for educating us on this. Steve in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi. I'm just trying to figure out, I just don't understand how the Republicans get around the common sense logic of public education. The more educated somebody is, the more money they make in their job.
That's what they will tell you.
The more taxes they pay, the more money there is for education. And more Republicans.
They're viewing it as a zero-sum game, Steve. They're viewing it as there's only a certain number of people who can really make it into the top 5% or the top 2% of wage earners. And, there's a limited demand for a limited number of doctors or engineers or whatever. And, in fact, that top pool is shrinking because now we've figured out ways to export those jobs. And so they want to make sure that it's their kids who are in there, not yours or mine.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
It's really fairly straightforward. And then the scam is they say, and the way that we should do it is with vouchers. What we're going to do is we're going to give everybody a $2,000. $2,500 was the last number I heard for one of the voucher programs that was, introduced at the federal level. We're going to give everybody a $2,500 voucher. Well, the average cost to educate a student in the United States is around $7,000-$8,000. And here in Oregon, it was around $9,000. A cheap private school is $7,000 or $8,000. I mean, a really down and dirty cheap private school is doing a decent job, $7,000-$8,000. So if you've got a $2,000 voucher, you can't afford to take your kids out of public school and come up with an additional $5,000. But on the other hand, if you're one of the wealthy elite and you already have your child in a private school, that $2,000 voucher becomes a $2,000 gift from the government for having put your child in a private school, which of course is what the whole voucher program is about. It's about paying off the wealthy elite or helping them out to make sure that their kids get whatever education they want. And making it look like they're doing something to help education.
Oh, there's still a logical flaw there, though, that just because you get more education, there are other jobs out there that don't involve necessarily being an engineer or a doctor. I have a degree in sciences and became a scientific consultant. Nothing to do with being a doctor or a lawyer. It's a homegrown United States-type job.
The reality is that the vast majority of the workforce of the United States historically has been blue collar, and now increasingly is pink collar, is service workers. It's not the quote white collar jobs. So that's where college education usually comes in white collar. I mean, I'm radically oversimplifying. But I would suggest to you that the reason conservatives want to destroy public education is because they really and truly do believe in a caste system. And they don't do it out of some evil intent. They really believe that the most stable society is a society that is run by a ruling elite that knows best. It's a variation on the concept of noblesse oblige. That those born into nobility have an obligation to take care of the rest of us, and they really know what's best, and they teach their children what's best, and the whole thing. And you see this right across the board. I mean, this was sort of how Joe Kennedy raised his kids as well. You have an obligation, and for them, for Jack and for Bobby and Teddy, that meant, go into public service and really defend the majority of the people. But for most conservatives, the concept of noblesse oblige means, like Bill Frist, his daddy's a billionaire, so he has to go out and promote the interests of billionaires.
In recorded history, has that ever worked out?
Oh, sure. It's a very stable form of government. It's called feudalism. Europe stayed that way for thousands of years. Japan was that way for thousands of years. China was that way for thousands of years. It is, and this is the conservatives will tell you, it is the most stable form of government. It's just not the most free. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. I talk about that, frankly, at length in two books that I've written, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, and What Would Jefferson Do, A Return to Democracy. Actually, and also the comic book that I did, We the People, Call to Take Back America. They all talk about that, how the conservatives really are. What they're really calling for is neo-feudalism, return to feudalism. And they're doing it out of, in my opinion, good intentions. It's just not the way that we want to live. 57 minutes after the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Abraham Lincoln: I'm a firm believer in the people. If given the truth, they can be depended upon to meet any national crisis. And the great point is to bring them the real facts. Coming up on today's program, by the way, in the second hour, Gary Weiss is going to be here with his new book, Wall Street versus America, The Rampant Greed and Dishonesty That Imperils Your Investment. And, of course, we're going to get into this whole topic of what happened when the dictator of communist China, Mr. Hu, was heckled this morning on the lawn of the White House, and what the consequences and fallout of that may be, and what it all means, and why George W. is kissing up to this guy. But right now, Mark Morano is with us. He's with Cybercast News Service, CNSnews.com, the website, a conservative news service. Mark Morano, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm happy to be here.
Mark, I don't know if you're the author of it, but there's this recent piece about suggesting basically that actually, I guess Susan Jones is the author. The San Francisco's anti-Catholic resolution prompts lawsuit. Give us the setup on this thing.
Yeah, this is the San Francisco City Council, or San Francisco Board of Supervisors, passed what conservative Catholic group, the Thomas More Law Center, is calling an anti-Catholic resolution. And what they essentially did, they passed a resolution urging local Catholic leaders in San Francisco area and Catholics to defy the Vatican directives telling Catholic adoption agencies not to place children with same-sex couples. And they essentially did this resolution, and they basically called the Vatican directive against homosexual adoptions, quote, hateful, discriminatory rhetoric that is both insulting and callous, shows a level of insensitivity and ignorance. And what happened was, because this came out of the Board of Supervisors as an official government action, it was only urging. This was not making anything illegal, but it was still official, had the official seal of the government on it. The Thomas More lawsuit is claiming that this is a violation of the first 14th Amendment. They filed a lawsuit against this, and of course the Catholic League for Religious Civil Rights, another group, has weighed in on this as well. And they're essentially accusing the San Francisco Board of Supervisors of anti-Catholic bigotry. And at the same time, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors is accusing the Catholic Church of anti-homosexual bigotry. So it's quite a quandary what's going on right now in San Francisco.
Isn't it legal for gays to adopt in California?
I believe it is legal, yes.
So then the Board of Supervisors is telling a corporation, basically, a nonprofit corporation, albeit, but nonetheless, the Catholic adoption agencies are corporations. They're telling a corporation that, in their opinion, they're not even mandating, that in their opinion, that corporation should comply with the law, and the corporation is saying that you're bigots?
The corporation is saying there's a separation of church and state. And this has a chilling effect. And what the fear here is because, granted it is San Francisco, and you would expect if any resolution were to pass in America, it would probably be San Francisco, because the Catholic teachings are diametrically opposed to, I guess, would you say, a large percentage of the population, homosexuals living in San Francisco. So there's always been sort of a tension there. But what the Thomas More Law Center is saying, what the Catholic League is saying, what many other Catholics are saying, is this is a chilling effect. It's essentially violating a separation of church and state because now it's like a hostile work environment. It's essentially Catholics in the city, Catholic institutions in the city, now feel as though they've been condemned by the local government for tenets of their faith, regardless of the law. We're talking about this is according to Catholic theology, according to the Vatican and the current Pope, the teachings on homosexuality. And
I understand. So, Mark Morano, I'm curious. Do you think that the laws in Utah, which make it illegal for the legally incorporated Mormon sects which practice polygamy, are an unlawful violation of the separation of church and state?
Obviously, there's limits to anything when you look at that. I haven't studied the polygamy issue, but I will say that, that is against the law, and that is something that used to be legal, but the government made it illegal. However, this is a private institution. This is an adoption agency that is run privately. It's not seeking the stamp of approval of the state in the sense that, like for instance, polygamy would be. You have to go to the state. You either need a minister ordained.
Well, adoption actually requires the approval of the state as well, Mark.
Just
as much as marriage does.
It's not a state adoption. I mean, it's a separate entity. It's a private.
No, but adoption still has to be validated and certified by the state in the exact same way that marriage is. There are certain legal rights that come with adoption and certain legal obligations that are not that dissimilar from marriage.
But are you alleging that? I mean, do you want to see now, you know, all faith, because you use the extreme example of polygamy, for instance. Do you want to see all faith now, particularly Catholic teaching on this? Do you want to see this? Don't you think there would be a line of violating separation of church and state? I mean, I understand.
My suggestion is that the Catholic teaching is the extreme teaching. If you look at the research that's been done on gay and lesbian adoptive parents, that you find that, number one, the kids aren't more or less likely to grow up gay. Number two, they do grow up with, you know, all the benefits of loving parents. I used to work in this field. I mean, from 1978 to 1983. Say what?
Oh, I said sure. Yeah, okay.
I mean, I was the executive director of a residential treatment facility for severely disturbed and emotionally disturbed kids and abused children in New Hampshire, the New England Salem Children's Trust. And I'm still on the board of directors of it here 27 years later. And I can tell you, there's 700,000 children in the system in the United States right now who really could benefit from having parents. Because being in an institution, even in a good institution like the one I used to run, is not a good thing for kids. And in my opinion, what you and what the Catholics in California would do is deprive these children of families that are actually willing to take them in, simply because those families happen to be made up of a gay couple.
Well,
this is wrong, in my opinion.
Catholic teaching has nothing to do with whether a child would grow up well, whether this or that, whether, you know, they would be happy, or whether they'd be more likely to grow up gay in a gay-headed household, or, you know, two parents of the same sex. They're basically saying that they consider homosexuality a sin, and the same.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Like the sermon on the mountain, says the Dharma got to come. Hellfire and brimstone, swap for oil and guns.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's skin of the teeth day. Tim in New York running around. You're doing good, Tim. And Dan and Alex, thank you. Welcome back to the program. No, I just to wrap this thing up. I don't think it's anti-Catholic for the city of San Francisco to say if you're going to put kids up for adoption, it's legal for gay couples to adopt them, and therefore you shouldn't discriminate against gay couples. That's called anti-discrimination policy. I mean, the Catholic Church once sanctioned slavery. Would it have been considered anti-Catholic to go along with that? The Catholic Church once sanctioned abortion. They once murdered witches. I mean, at some point, you stand up and you say, no. You know, the bigotry du jour, and it's not limited to the Catholic Church. You find this across American society and particularly across fundamentalist religious society in the United States. And it's not limited just to even Christianity. But there is this endemic, long-standing, deeply rooted bigotry against gays, and I think it's tragic, and particularly tragic when there's 700,000 more or less kids in the system who are on a daily basis being harmed by the fact that they are growing up, they're going through the developmental phase of their life without parents, without people who really love them and are willing to care for them and can do right by them, gay or straight. And instead are living in institutions or are living in foster homes where they're you know, cycled through and you know, I mean, a lot of foster parents are just doing a great and noble work. And I can tell you, I've been out there, I've seen it. There are foster parents who are basically running foster homes the way that, you know, some dog breeders are running puppy kennels. You know, it's basically how many can we move through here? How much money can we make on it? And that's a tragedy too. And but even in the very best of foster homes, and as I said, there are many wonderful foster homes out there. Even in the best of foster homes, the kids are still in limbo. They're still outside the system, or they're still caught up in the system outside of a family. And if a family's available, a family wants to take them in, that family should be eligible to, regardless of their sexual orientation. Paula in Bayonne, New Jersey. Our phone number, 800-440-8466. Hey, Paula, what's up?
Hey, Tom. This issue gets me so angry. As a former Catholic, I really, really get annoyed with the inconsistencies.
For example,
well, let's take, first of all, your guest, when he was saying that this is merely a matter of church doctrine. Am I wrong, but don't adoptions have to go through the court system?
Yeah, that was my point. This is actually a legal process.
And the court systems are funded by taxpayers, and as a taxpayer,
right.
I'm not interested in supporting bigotry.
Yes. Well, and there was a time, you know, when the Catholic Church in the United States conformed with actually what were the laws at the time. I don't know if it was Catholic policy or not, but the adoption agencies would not adopt children into different racial groups, parents, you know. I think we've all kind of shaken our heads and looked back and said, boy, those were the bad old days.
And as far as just the ingenuous he was when he tried to like separate this topic from the death penalty or from the war,
yeah,
or from abortion. Now Arnold Schwarzenegger had a chance within the last 6 months to spare two men their lives
mm-hmm.
on death row, and he chose not to. There was nothing said by the Catholic Church about that, by the American Catholic Church.
No, because he's a conservative Republican.
And during the election, I was angry when how many times was John Kerry was denied communion because of his opinion on abortion?
Well, and do you know why that was? That was because the guy who is the current pope was then the head of the department in the church, the Office of Doctrine, I believe it's called, which is the current incarnation of the old Office of the Inquisition. And you know, and his job is to keep the church doctrine pure. And he sent letters out to to bishops in the United States saying that John Kerry, essentially implicitly, that any Catholic politician who believes or who argues that politically abortion should be legalized or should remain legal in the United States should be denied communion. I mean, this is the current pope back in the 2004 election interfering in U.S. politics.
Exactly, and there's one point I want to bring up about him that doesn't come up a lot, but I think in this context it is an appropriate, it's appropriate to bring it up. This is a man who came of age in Nazi Germany.
Yeah, well,
and I'm
willing to cut him some slack for that.
What kind of influence did that have on him?
Yeah.
Or perhaps it's more than just church doctrine.
He's not the only guy saying this, Paula. I mean, you know, Mark Morano didn't come of age in Nazi Germany. He's saying the same thing.
I think it's for people like Mark Morano, which is just politically expedient for conservatives to bash gays.
Yeah,
I don't think they care, but I think that's how
disagree.
They get the religious right out.
Yeah. Well, and it seems to work for some of these politicians. Paul, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Rick in Grand Rapids. Rick, we just have a few seconds left. Quick thought.
Well, I don't know if I can get it all in.
Okay, give it a shot.
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with this.
Yeah, hang on. We'll give it a shot when we come back. We're having strange times here with the automation.
Okay,
it's
thank you.
Hang on.
I'll hold.
Thanks. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. We're going to get back into the issue of what's going on in China, too, and come back at the bottom of the hour here. We'll be back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And it's gone, gone, going, gone. Everything gone, give a damn. Gone be the birds when they don't want to sing. Gone people.
And welcome back, my friends. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. It's the Tom Hartman program. That's me. 34 minutes past the hour. Glad to have you with us and glad to be here. We've got some really interesting immigration stuff in the news, we're going to get to in a few minutes. What's going on in China? Or is it who's going on? No, who? No, what? No, yeah, who's on first? Yeah. Who was heckled on the White House lawn today? Yes. All right, we'll get to that in just a minute. Rick in Grand Rapids, you were making a point, Rick.
Well, yeah, you've been talking about religion there the last few minutes, and certainly religion should be a good thing, but of course the fundamentalist type, whether it occurs in Catholic religion, Protestant, or Islamic, can be quite dangerous, as we can see with world events. But a couple of nights ago, I was watching, well, I won't mention the name of the host, you know, the liberal and the conservative on Fox.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and they had this woman on. I guess she's the daughter of this Fred Phelps guy, the guy who's apparently organizing protests.
Yeah, the God hates fags guy.
Yeah, that, I wasn't going to say the word.
They're doing the protests at the funerals of soldiers who died in Iraq.
These are dead gay soldiers, apparently.
Actually, they're doing all soldiers.
Oh, now. They're doing it all.
These guys are just so desperate for publicity. They're saying that the reason why the soldiers died is because God is punishing America because we sanction homosexuality.
Okay, I don't think
that's
we do.
That's their shtick.
But anyway, this woman was so hateful that even the conservative guy was having a real problem with her. And I got to tell you, I've seen Ann Coulter on many times, but this woman has got her beat, and it's apparent that her father has just, you know, this is not a young woman. I mean, she's a young woman, but she's no kid. And it's just apparent that her father has just brainwashed her.
Yeah, Fred Phelps is running a little cult there, the Westboro Baptist
right,
Church.
But his own daughter has become such a hateful individual.
And most of the members of his cult are actually members of his family. I'm just amazed that anybody takes them seriously.
Well, of course, I guess when you put them on nationwide television, you're right. I guess you do give them too much publicity. But
this is why I don't have them on the show. I mean, they don't represent Christianity any more than, I can't even come up with an example. I mean, any more than, you know, chocolate fudge represents Christianity. I mean, there's such a disconnect there. What they represent. Yeah, I mean, they're closer to the KKK than they are to Christianity. And the KKK, by the way, represents itself as a Christian organization. That's probably a better metaphor.
But it probably would be a good disinfectant to let people know that this kind of malicious culture.
This is the logical end point of that kind of bigotry. Good point, Rick. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Bob in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. I agree. I think it's a government or a state issue, too. And, you know, since when is adopting, you know, a kid, you know, a bad thing?
Right.
And, you know, why would Holy Mother Church decide to go get involved in this? They have other issues that they probably should be addressing. But then again, you know, even if, you know, there's been some known people who have went out and disagreed with the church and a lot of their views. And I'll give you, for instance, like Hans Kung, who is pretty progressive. And look what ended up happening to him. And he's one of the smartest minds in all of Catholicism. And they defrocked him. And, I mean, he's an outcast.
I'm not Catholic. I'm not familiar with Hans. What's the very in a sentence or two? What's the story there, Bob?
He had such opposing views as to what was going on in the Catholic Church, and he was, matter of fact, he gave the new Pope his first job. And he was defrocked because of a lot of his views.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is something to be said for a religion or a cult or a sect maintaining consistency in their theology and perspective. And while I would be the first to suggest that when a religion or a cult or a sect becomes any kind of institutionalized, you know, expression of religion becomes involved in matters of governance, in matters of the state, that they have become toxic. On the other hand, I think that internally they have every right to. You know, Reverend Moon, if he and his followers want to do whatever they want to do, he wants to marry, you know, 1,000 people at once who've never met each other, that's between Reverend Moon and his followers, in my opinion. I don't have a problem with it. I'd cringe a little if one of my kids was involved with it. I'd cringe a lot, actually. But when Reverend Moon decides that he wants to change U.S. foreign policy by buying the Washington Times and making it the only newspaper that conservatives read in Washington, D.C., then I have a big problem with it. But, you know, otherwise it's like keep the cults within the cults. Brian in Manchester, New Hampshire. Hey, Brian.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Hi, yeah, first about the Catholic, I don't see how any gay adopting a child is oppressing Catholics at all in this country or any other. But getting back to this
point, and there have to be gay Catholic couples.
Right, okay, well, that's... Okay, it's a Catholic adoption agency?
Yeah, it's a Catholic adoption agency, and you know, I know gay Catholics. There have to be gay Catholic couples out there who want to adopt. And,
oh, yeah. Just before I went in the service out in West Hollywood, California, there's a huge gay Catholic church in West Hollywood there that has a huge congregation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, talking about Pope Benedict, I wonder myself how he even was allowed to take over from this great Polish lad that he took over the papal title from.
John Paul II was, I think, far more conservative than most people realize.
Yeah.
And Benedict was following his line.
But you have to remember, Tom, that Benedict was involved in moving these priests around, these monsters that were alleged child molesters when they should have been taken to the police station for trial. And he was involved in that, and he's trying to tell John Kerry about morals.
Well, yeah, I don't know that that's the case. It may well be. I just don't know.
It's in the history. But also, and one other thing, I'm reading your book, Ultimate Sacrifice, about the talk about the first Catholic president, the first non-WASP president, really, John F. Kennedy.
Right.
He was easy. I think he was. Our king was assassinated right before our eyes. But talking about the mafia connection, Johnny Roselli, he was friends with Sinatra, and Sinatra was close friends with JFK, right?
Yeah, sort of. Sinatra and JFK, I wouldn't call them close friends, but they certainly knew each other socially, yeah.
Okay, but to me, Sinatra was so connected to the mob and so close to Johnny Roselli, how could he not have known to then warn Jack Kennedy about what Roselli had intended for him and the other?
I don't think Sinatra knew.
No.
These guys, they knew how to keep things close to the vest. But I don't want to get into the whole Kennedy assassination.
Well, I'm not
By the way, with the History Channel in May is going to be doing a special based on our book, in part based on our book. So I'll let you all know when the date comes for that. Brian, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Elaine in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Elaine. Elaine?
Yes.
Welcome to the program. You are live on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that we adopted a foster child from the state about a year ago, and we're considering adopting a drug baby, and Catholic Services here handles those babies. My partner and I are single, but we're male-female, and I called, and they would have allowed that.
So they would, which is contrary to church teachings. You're living in sin.
Exactly. Now, why would they allow that? I'm sure what would happen is that it would just never come up, that it would be assumed that we were married. The gay thing, I'm sure, because of the fact that it's same sex, they can't cover that.
Right. They can't. But, they can't wink, wink, nod, nod.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I thought that was quite interesting to hear the program this morning about homosexuals not being allowed to adopt. There is such a need.
Yeah, but what this is, you're absolutely right, Elaine. What this is the right wing is getting ready for the 2006 elections. And
right.
What they are trying to do is put these wedge issues front and center in front of the American people and they're going to start beating the drum and, the gays are coming, you know.
Right.
It's one year it's, the flag burners are coming.
Another year it's
Willie Horton is coming. You know, this year it's going to be the gays are coming. And
right.
I just don't think it's going to fly. I think these guys are shooting themselves in the foot. Elaine, thanks for the call and thanks for the heads up on that. Interesting.
Sorry.
Jan in Fairfax, Virginia. Hey, Jan, welcome to the program.
How are you?
I am great. What's up?
Good. I used to run a social service agency in Boston, St. Francis House, which is the largest homeless program in Boston. It was funded by the Franciscans. And it's a bad mix, having religion overlaying, imposing their philosophy in any service delivery arena, including adoption or homelessness, because there's strings attached and it interferes with the effective intervention. I mean, we couldn't give condoms to homeless retarded women. I mean, it's just not a good mix.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tragic. I mean, now we're back to the big debate that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison had. Jefferson believed that both of them were opposed to the intermixing of church and state. And Jefferson's fear was that somebody who was involved in the church would someday get into politics and start, you know, messing with politics. In other words, the church would try to take over the government, because that had happened in the state of Massachusetts in his lifetime. He'd seen it happen. And Madison didn't believe that was possible. Madison was much younger than Jefferson, although actually it was going on. I mean, Massachusetts almost seceded in 1800. Madison, though, wasn't so concerned about the church taking over the state. He was concerned that if the state gave money to the churches, it would corrupt the churches. And that's why the first presidential veto of James Madison, the fourth president's presidency, was vetoing a bill that gave money to a church, a Protestant church in Washington, D.C., to care for the homeless. And he said, we can't do this. If we want to care for these people, and we will allocate money for it, but it can't go through a church. It has to be a secular thing.
Because it is an altruism. It's not when the state delivers the service, there's some degree of altruism, or at least there's
supposed
to be. When the Catholic Church delivers it, it's imposed, it's infused with philosophy. You have to buy into their...
It's not just altruism at that point, then it also becomes evangelism. Jan, thank you for the call, and a very good point you make. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I hear the voices.
I'm a war president.
Bring them on. I hear the voices.
Uh-oh.
Subvert the legislature.
I hear the voices.
We will not turn back.
Yeah, he hears the voices. Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we run rings around the right wing. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Right here, wherever you may be listening to us. Very glad to have you with us. Phil in Baton Rouge, Louisiana on the line. Hey, Phil, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I just wonder how much does it cost to fill up a container ship that ships cheap goods from China back to the United States. You've got raw materials that go to Chinese, basically Chinese/American factories, because a lot of U.S. Entrepreneurs have invested in factories in China.
Right.
So then,
although when they do, they have to have a Chinese partner, because the Chinese won't let Americans do what the Chinese can do, which is go in and simply buy a company and own it.
Right, but they'll take advantage of the cheap labor in China.
That's right. They'll let us go in and have a partnership with a local Chinese entrepreneur and start a business. But you can't have 100% American ownership of Chinese companies.
Well, I know of a business here in the city I live in, a Baton Rouge company that sells rattan furniture that they fly to China, they take a working vacation, they order the furniture according to the way they want it made. It gets custom made. They buy container loads of this stuff, ship it back to Baton Rouge, and then sell it. You know, they have a shop here in Baton Rouge that sells that furniture. Well, what is the price of fuel going to do to that?
Well, it's going to raise it slightly, but the transportation cost on the stuff coming from China is not really all that substantial. Transpacific shipping is really startlingly efficient in terms of the amount of fuel that goes into one little goodie, a plasma TV or a computer or a knickknack or whatever, a piece of rattan furniture.
So the only negotiable price is the labor price.
That's the major price, yeah. The major variable is the cost of labor. Yep.
Oh, also, before I let you go, thanks again for The Ultimate Sacrifice. I read it. It's a great book. I appreciate you for the book. I'll just put in a shameless plug for it. Everybody ought to read it.
Okay, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Tom.
Good to hear from you. Thank you. Yeah, and in fact, I believe it's going to be May 10th that the History Channel or the Discovery Channel. Oh, I'm going to have to look it up now. It's one or the other. It's going to be doing something on this, and I'll let you know all the details on that. In fact, let's see here. It looks like it's going to be on the Discovery Channel. Indeed, the Discovery Channel. It's called Conspiracy Files: JFK Assassination. Also includes John Newman, me, Lamar Waldron. Actually, I'm not sure if I'll be in there. It may just be Lamar. We'll see. We both went to New York and were filmed on this thing. And it looks like it's going to be on May 10th. So, well, you know, we'll see how it all shakes out. But just as an FYI, May 11th, excuse me, on May 11th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and again on May 12th at 1 a.m. This is, and here's a, we were just talking about the cost of labor. Considered felons, this is an Associated Press story, considered felons by their government, these migrants fear detention, rape, and robbery. Police and soldiers hunt them down at railroads, bus stations, and flea bag motels. Sometimes they're deported. More often, officers simply take their money. What country am I talking about? The level of brutality that these migrants face was apparent Monday when police conducting a raid for undocumented migrants near a rail yard shot to death a local man, apparently because his dark skin and work clothes made officers think he was a migrant. Virginia Sanchez, who lives near the railroad tracks that carry Central Americans north to the U.S. border, said such shootings in Tultitlan, Mexico, are common. We're talking about Mexico here. This is how Mexico treats illegal immigrants. At night, she says, you hear the gunshots, and it's the judiciales, the state police, chasing the migrants. Carlos Lopez, a 28-year-old farmhand from Guatemala, said if you're carrying any money, they take it from you. The federal, state, local police, all of them. He's crouching in a field near the tracks in whatever the name of the city is, waiting to climb on a northbound freight train. Lopez said he had been shaken down repeatedly in 15 days of traveling through Mexico. He said the soldiers are there as soon as we cross the river. He said, you can't cross unless you leave something for us. Jose Ramos, 18, of El Salvador, says the extortion occurs at every stop in Mexico until migrants are left penniless and begging for food. He said if you're on a bus, they pull you off and search your pockets, and if you have any money, they keep it and say, get out of here. Maria Elena Gonzalez, who lives near the track, said female migrants often complain about abusive police. She said they force you to strip, supposedly to search you, but the purpose is to rape you. And this goes, Interior Secretary Carlos Abascal said Monday that Mexico is a country with a clear, this is the Mexican Interior Secretary, with a clear, defined, and generous policy toward migrants. Although the nation of 105 million, Mexico, has only legalized, in the past 5 years, they have only legalized 15,000 immigrants from all countries in the world. Mexico, over the last 5 years, has only allowed legally into their country 15,000 people. And illegal immigrants, they hunt them down and shoot them. And while Mexicans denounce the criminalization of their citizens living without papers in the United States, this is from the Associated Press, Mexican law classifies undocumented immigration as a felony punishable by up to 2 years in prison. Isn't that fascinating? If you illegally immigrate into Mexico, they will hunt you down, they will shoot you, or they will put you in prison for 2 years because you are a felon. The country of Mexico, in 5 years, a five-year period, has only legalized 15,000 immigrants. We legalize about 1 million immigrants a year in the United States. And they're saying that we have a wrong immigration policy? This is mind-boggling. Considered felons by the government, these migrants fear detention, rape, and robbery. And they're talking about people from Central America immigrating into Mexico from the south. Mind-boggling. Meanwhile, in the United States, the Immigration Service, the INS, starting to arrest both workers and bosses. We'll see how this plays out. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.